I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital provides cardiac care for the poor in India, and Dr. Shetty started the hospital in 2001. Welcome, Dr. Shetty.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
I'm speaking with you over the phone. You are currently in your home in India. Could you explain in your own words what Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital does?
The idea is to bring cardiac surgery to everyone. My country requires 2.5 million heart surgeries a year. And currently, we are all the heart hospitals in the country put together only doing about 90,000 heart surgeries. Jessica, first heart surgery was done 100 years ago. 100 years later, only 8% of the world's population can afford heart operation. Something has to be done. Narayana Rudayalaya Heart Hospital has 1,000 beds, and we have 24 operation theaters. The infrastructure is currently performing about 30 major heart surgeries a day, but that is half of our capacity. And about 30% of our workload is on children coming from 65 countries for heart operation. And about 60% to 70% of the work is adult cardiac surgery.
What is the cost of open heart surgery to somebody who could afford it in India?
Approximately a heart operation on a child who can't afford to pay for the operation would cost about $1,400. The same operation in the U.S. might cost you around $200,000.
What are the primary factors in the business model of low-cost heart surgery? How are you managing to provide low-cost care to India's poor population?
First thing is you have to build a hospital differently. If you build a 100-bed, 200-bed hospital, you cannot reduce the cost. Because in a hospital, bulk of the cost goes for a hard infrastructure like blood bank, laboratories, CT scans, MRIs, PET scans. These are very, very expensive instruments. And what we do is we buy all these advanced machines, but we use them for 24 hours. To run it for 24 hours, you need a large number of outpatients. Large number of outpatients will come, provided you are affordable. Mm. So first thing is we build hospitals in about 15 to 25 acres of land. And then we plan to build 5,000 beds, which we build in phases. So if you have large number of beds, then you do more operations. As you do more operations, your results get better. As your results get better, your cost also goes down. And because of these two reasons, more people will come to you.
What were you doing prior to opening the hospital?
I graduated from a medical college called Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, Mangalore in India. Then, like most Indian doctors, I went to England for training in cardiac surgery. Then I came back to Calcutta. I was one of the first few heart surgeons to come back to India to set up cardiac surgical unit. It was in 1989, where cardiac surgery was a mystery to most of my citizens. And when I started my career in Calcutta, if I saw 100 patients per day, not even one person could afford the heart operation. Then I realized that unless I take care of the ability to pay or the paying capacity of the patient, I wouldn't have a practice. So this is how everything started.
You conducted surgery on Mother Teresa. How was that a turning point for you, if at all?
Meeting Mother, as a scientist, I would never accept another human being with flesh and blood like me as God. But I can tell you that Mother was truly God in human form. Being with her, interacting with her, maybe as a heart surgeon treating her, it was a turning point in my career. Her simplicity, her approach towards the realities of life, it made a tremendous impact. And she gave me the fantastic definition of the definition for a pediatric cardiac surgeon. One day I was going for rounds and she was following me. She was, even though she was an inpatient, she looked at the kids I operated. Then she looked at my eyes and she said, "Doc, I know why you're here." I said, why, mother, why am I here? He said, when God made these children with the heart disease, he was probably preoccupied. Then he realized there was a problem and he sent you to fix it. And that is the best definition one could give for a pediatric cardiac surgeon.
How religious were you prior to meeting Mother Teresa?
I was always religious, no, undoubtedly. I was born and brought up in a typical Hindu family down south, where religion is part of our life. But she reinforced my belief in God. She convinced me that the best way to serve God is by serving mankind. So I still have a poster of Mother Teresa in my office, which says, hands which help are better than the lips that pray.
And Narayana Rudayalaya, the name of your hospital, means God's compassionate home.
Essentially, in India, primarily we revolve our life around God and the cosmic forces. We wanted to create something unique, something big, which would make a difference to the society. Rudaya is heart. Alaya is temple.
We talk about Mother Teresa having this seminal impact on you, but was the train on the tracks to create this hospital even prior to your meeting her?
I think I was in the process of thinking about doing something different, something big. And this interaction with Mother, which lasted for close to 5 years, definitely had an impact on where I wanted to reach. Definitely it had a big impact in terms of looking after the underprivileged are the main concern and the pivotal role it had in building this institution.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Now, the institution or the hospital is in Bangalore, India, and Bangalore is known as sort of the Silicon Valley of India, where there's a lot of technical innovation. Why did you choose to locate the hospital in Bangalore? Was it accidental or was it purposeful?
My wife is from Bangalore. That is one of the main attractions to come back to Bangalore. But, you know, it's a coincidence that Bangalore happens to be the Silicon Valley and so many exciting developments are happening in Bangalore. That definitely helped our objective. But the decision to come back to Bangalore was coming back home.
You mentioned your wife, and it was your in-laws who funded the project. What did your mother or father-in-law do that enabled them to have enough capital to fund the hospital?
My father-in-law was running a very successful construction company, in fact, around 20 years ago. So towards the end of his professional life, he wanted to build a hospital to make a difference to the society. But he had only one condition, a condition that we should never refuse any child who comes to us with a heart disease, irrespective of caste, creed, and nationality. Mm-hmm. And this is something which he firmly believed, and he insisted that we do it. That's the only condition he had. And we carried on, and this is how the whole thing started.
It seems, Dr. Shetty, that there was this real kind of perfect intersection of Mother Teresa and your medical expertise and your father-in-law all coming together to create this hospital. Do you ever think about that, kind of the stars aligning?
You're right. I strongly believe in that, Jessica. I strongly believe in cosmic forces. Long, long ago, Jessica, I received a donation of 100,000 rupees from one of the army soldiers from Madras. He refused to give his name, and he wrote one note saying that the path you have chosen, the amount of money I am giving is too small, but God has his own mysterious ways of doing the rest. This is exactly what happened in my life. These are all strange coincidences at every level of my life, but I strongly believe that there is somebody up there with the proper design, which is a mystery to me. And that's what keeps happening all the time.
So you decide to launch this initiative in Bangalore. How did you get the land to build this vast health campus?
Our country is made up of 32 states. And these states have chief ministers and the government. And these governments are very supportive of hospital projects by people like us. So So we get land virtually free, or we get land for a token amount of money, because government wants this type of large initiatives to come up.
Your hospital is performing roughly 7,000 surgeries a year, and often your doctors are being paid less than doctors elsewhere in the country. How is morale among your doctors?
We have zero attrition rate. No doctor has ever left us. I guess there is not even only one person left in the last 15 years for family reasons. Now, why people stick around, even though their salary is not up to the level what they can get elsewhere, is because as surgeons, if you want to attract them, they need much more than money. They want to do something else. And we always provide what they want, because I am one among them. Every day, children come to us. You know, typically a newborn baby who's very, very blue comes to you. We look at the kid. We tell the mother, baby requires operation. The baby goes to the OT, comes back to the ICU, and we call the mother to see the baby after 4 hours. Mother looks up the baby and say, look, this is not my child. Then we say, that is your child. Then we say, then the mother says, look, he was dark, he was black before you did the operation. Then we tell her that, yeah, he was dark, but now he's pink. Then she will touch the baby, and then she will look at our eyes and say, will he always remain like this? Then we say, yeah, he's going to remain like that. So in a matter of 5 hours, we have transformed the lives of these people. So this is something which you can never buy, irrespective of what money, you know, what you're prepared to trade.
You mentioned before that 30% of the surgeries that you conduct in your hospital is for babies or pediatric care. Why is it so high? Is it larger in India than in other countries?
Jessica, you remember, we produce 28 million babies a year. We produce the largest number of babies in the world. One out of 140 children born anywhere in the world has heart disease. That means technically we produce about 600 to 1,000 children a day with heart disease. And someone has to fix their heart, because these children, if they are operated the moment they are born or in the first few months of their life, you can cure them. So someone has to do it. So we are privileged to be that someone to fix these children's heart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a medical entrepreneur who's creating a new healthcare economic model in India by providing affordable cardiac care for India's poor population. We'll hear more from Dr. Devi Shetty coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Over 7,000 surgeries take place in his Nayararana Rudayalaya Hospital, located in Bangalore, India. Dr. Shetty founded the hospital in 2001. Now, you offer a form of insurance called Yashasvini. Can you talk a little bit about the germ of the idea for providing insurance?
The Karnataka Milk Federation, which is a conglomeration of milk producers, they requested me to sponsor one of their low-fat milk, claiming that it's good for the heart. And I agreed to endorse their product, provided the Milk Federation agrees to offer health insurance to the people who sell milk. So they agreed to do that. This is how we started the micro health insurance for the people, farmers who sell milk. And it started with a premium of 11 cents per month. We kept the premium at 11 cents because that is the price of local cigarette called BD they smoke. So the idea was to promote this concept that instead of smoking BD, you buy a health insurance and you will be protected for major illnesses. Today it has grown. This insurance has now spread to other states of the country. Everywhere, 60%, 80% of state population is covered by the health insurance.
So this health insurance that you offer started with this milk cooperative, essentially this group of farmers who, as you say, pay 11 cents a month for insurance. Can you talk a little bit about the rural poor? I mean, your hospital is in Bangalore, in a major city, but how are you addressing the needs of the rural poor who can't be transported to the hospital in time if they're having a heart attack, for example?
First thing is, when they develop heart attack, we look after their heart attack from remote areas, from the satellite. We have, you know, Jessica, there are 5 countries in the world which can put satellite on the space, and India is one of those countries. And we have been chosen to be partners with the Indian Space Research Organization to help them to monitor the astronauts when India eventually puts the man on the moon. And we have satellite connection free of cost. So we put up these satellite collection in remote government hospitals and manage heart attack and heart failure sitting in Bangalore or Calcutta. And till date, we have treated over 53,000 heart patients in remote locations.
Can you walk me through, let's say Devi the farmer is having a heart attack or is having some heart trouble. Can you walk me through what happens to him?
Yeah, let's put it this way. A farmer in Hubli, which is about 300 kilometers from Bangalore, if he develops a heart attack, he will go to a general practitioner with chest pain. And most general practitioners down south has a ECG machine, which is linked to the telephone line. And as soon as he does the ECG, it comes to our hospital. And in less than 5 minutes, we give the report to the telephone line. And if it is diagnosed as heart attack, we ask them to go to a coronary care unit in a government hospital or one of our satellite units over there. So the primary care is taken care of. That will save about 95% of the victims of heart attack. And after about 1 month, they will come to Bangalore for further evaluation. And there we do the angiogram and, if required, operation.
You mentioned the Indian Space Research Organization that helps you use satellites for this cardiac care. Whose idea was it to use this space research organization?
The Indian Space Research Organization, they wanted us to help them in monitoring the vitals of astronauts. So we are helping them in their project, and they help us to give the satellite connection free of cost. Right now, sitting in Bangalore, we treat patients in 56 cities of Africa where our satellites are beamed. But the exciting thing, Jessica, I'll tell you, when we do liver transplants on children in Bangalore, do you know who gives the anesthesia for the kids? The anesthesia is given by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in America.
Wait, so can you explain that to me, how a hospital in Philadelphia is helping you with a liver transplant in Bangalore?
We have extremely skilled surgeons who can do the liver transplant. But our anesthetists are cardiac anesthetists. They do not know the details about managing very sick child who is undergoing a liver transplant, where the operation lasts for 10 hours, 12 hours. So we tied up with Children's Hospital Philadelphia. The anesthetists there, they realize that since we have the satellite link up, they can sit in the operating room of Philadelphia and manage the anesthesia of the kid who's undergoing operation in Bangalore. Other than touching, they can do everything.
So we talk about, Dr. Shetty, you're creating a health city, but it sounds, with this example of the connection with Philadelphia and also serving African patients, that essentially you're creating a health world.
Trying to, Jessica.
My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital started off serving cardiac care for India's poor, and now its health centers help patients who have heart problems, eye problems, arthropedic issues, and cancer as well. Could you provide some anecdotes to help us understand what you do on a daily basis?
I start my work very early in the morning. Generally, my colleagues start the surgery at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I reach the hospital by around 7:30. Then I have to see at least 70 to 100 patients every day in the outpatient. That's the time patients come, they talk to me about their problems, I console them, try to organize financial assistance. And the, essentially, it's like a meeting area for the patients. I spend about 5 hours with the patient. Then around 12 o'clock, I start the surgery. And I generally concentrate on operations called pulmonary endarterectomies or aneurysms. This is my area of interest. And sometimes I operate on newborn babies. Then as soon as I finish the operation, then maybe half an hour or an hour with my team discussing about various strategies and management issues. Then again, the outpatient. And then it's around 9:30, 10 o'clock. That's the time to go home.
You mentioned you see 70 to 100 patients per day in a span of 5 hours?
Yes. I generally try to spend about 2 to 3 minutes with each patient. Everything has been done by my colleagues. The diagnosis is made. The planning was made. Everything is done. But most of these people, unless I see them and unless I touch them, they wouldn't like to go for the operation. Mm-hmm. So it is essentially getting to know the family and explain to them that this is what we are planning to do. It is just reassurance that I am there to help them. I try to see at least in 5 minutes about 2 patients. I have a very big clock hung in front of the wall so that I'm constantly reminded. And I have a very fancy chair made by Herman Miller, which can move from one end of the table to the other end like a Ziffy. So I can turn my chair on and off and, you know, facing one patient, and the second minute I'm facing another patient.
Incidentally, was the Herman Miller chair donated?
That's a good question. It is actually gifted by my son. When he graduated, I guess he earned some money, and he was looking at me struggling with the old Indian chair where the wheels used to get stuck up. You see, what happens when I talk to a patient, the first 2 minutes is about talking to the patient, getting to, you know, convincing them about the treatment and all that. Then they are happy with the treatment. Then they start talking about, you know, I operated on their uncle or a father or a grandfather, how well he is or how grateful I am and all that. That's the time I try to move my chair to the other side of the table. Mm. And I need very good wheels. And my son realized that Herman Miller is the best chair.
So really what you're giving to these, you know, 100 patients is emotional consultation versus medical consultation.
Perfect. Yeah, you got it right, Jessica.
Do you worry at all that there's this kind of Walmartization of healthcare? In order for your hospital or for your low-cost health plan to work, you really have to serve many, many, many patients. You know, as you say, you're seeing 100 patients a day. You're doing 2 operations a day. This is obviously far more than the international average. Do you ever worry about the optics of that?
Not really. In the sense, see, there are a lot of changes happening in the country. Now, people, when they come to us, they're a lot more knowledgeable about what we are doing in the heart operation. So they have less questions. They're mentally prepared when they come. And also, my team is growing. So I'm surrounded by physician assistants and well-trained doctors. So essentially, I wouldn't say that as the workload goes up, we lose touch with the patients and the emotional aspect of it. I don't think it will happen. Mm. I think it's only getting better as the time passed by.
You talk about being at work around 7 in the morning and going home around 10 at night. What does your wife think about this?
She was finding it. She comes from a very rich family. So, she was initially a bit disappointed. But then, you know, as the family grew, now my children are grown up. My oldest son is an engineer. He's building all the hospitals. And my second son is a doctor. Third son is in the medical school. She kind of likes my profession, even though she doesn't admit. All along, she cursed my profession. But when my oldest son decided to become an engineer, and one day he declared that, "Daddy, I want to become an engineer," I said, "All right, that's good." Then she just the hell broke loose. And I said, what happened? She said, why he doesn't want to become a doctor? Then I said, all along you have been cursing my profession, and you're disappointed your son doesn't want to become a doctor. That's the time I realized maybe my wife likes my profession.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Dr. Shetty, your public health initiative has been quite successful against many odds. Could you talk about some of those odds or hurdles that you had to jump over in order to provide low-cost health care to the poor population in India?
When I started my career, the greatest difficulty was convincing people to undergo the operation. The heart surgery was in an infantile stage. Then once I accomplished it, the problem was the affordability.
You have this vision of having 30,000 beds in your health center. What are the hurdles to making that happen? Are they financial? Are they getting people's imaginations to understand what that means? What are those hurdles?
See, the first thing is we strongly believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from affluence, healthcare from your bank balance. If there is one country in the world which can do it, that is India, because we produce the largest number of doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the world. We have the largest number of US FDA-approved drug manufacturing units outside USA. We have everything required for a fantastic healthcare delivery system. But there is something which can prevent this from happening, that is lack of adequate beds. That is the reason why we want to create these 30,000 beds. Our biggest stumbling block now is arranging funds at our terms to roll out this many beds in a short duration of time without really losing control of the organization. This has been the challenge, because regular financial mechanisms will not be able to help us. So the challenge is raising equity, raising money for all this massive scale expansion.
What is your annual budget?
I guess around $100 to $120 million.
Per year. It costs about $200,000 for a patient in the United States to have open heart surgery. And you're building a center or a hospital, cardiac care center, in the Cayman Islands so that United States citizens and those nearby could benefit from low-cost surgery. Why does it cost $200,000 in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S., the cost structure is radically different. You see, we work for 6 days in a week, whereas in the U.S., it's only 5 days in a week. Plus, your nurses and doctors generally work for 48 hours in a week, whereas we work virtually double the number of hours. So in U.S. hospitals, traditionally 65% of the revenue goes for the salaries, while in Indian hospitals it's about 20%. So essentially the cost structure, the litigation, the malpractice suits, these are all issues which would jack up the price. And also there is large insurance companies, you know, with their own, agenda. So essentially, it is a business where there are too many people with too many rigid rules and regulations, and there is absolutely no scope for innovation in the process of delivery. You just cannot innovate.
Hopefully, now that you'll be setting up a center in the Cayman Islands, some competition will cause the U.S. to get their butts in gear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think I would like to compete with the American hospitals. I just want to show our modest way of doing things.
You mentioned malpractice and lawsuits in the United States. How common are medical malpractice lawsuits in India?
It's extremely, extremely small, primarily because as surgeons, we spend a lot of time with the patients before operation. We make things very clear to the family. So they don't have unrealistic expectations.
Doctor, you've changed so many people's lives. You've improved so many people's lives by providing low cost cardiac care. Is there a story or two that come to your mind to demonstrate this?
See, essentially, I am like anybody else in the patient community, because as a kid, I am the eighth child of a family with nine children. So when I grew up, my parents were old. My vivid memories about my father is an elderly person who goes in and out of the hospital because of diabetes complications. So in my life, doctors remained as very important people, and this may be one of the reasons why I decided to become a doctor. So when I interact with the patients, when I see a young lady with a young husband undergoing heart operation with young children, when I operate on them, I think about my life. In case my father had an operation, needed an operation when he was young, and if something happened to him, we would all be on the street. So, you know, these patients' lives are no different than our life. I guess this is one of the greatest motivating factors for all of us to do our best to save their life.
Well, Dr. Shetty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was a great experience talking to you, because you are the first Western interviewer who could pronounce the name of my hospital.
My guest has been Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Coming up, we'll meet Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Roy and Bertrand Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, the first prepaid debit card company for the underbanked population in the United States. NetSpend was launched in 1999 and targets people who don't have access to credit cards or hold bank accounts. Roy and Bertrand started the company out of their one-bedroom apartment in Texas with $750. They later raised $1.5 billion in an IPO in 2010 and sold the company in early 2013 to Total System Services, a payment processing company, for approximately $1.4 billion. They are the co-founders of Empower Ventures, an investment fund focused on financial service companies for the underbanked. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You immigrated from Mexico to the United States in 1986 when you were teenagers. What were your first impressions of America, Bertrand?
As the World Turns, because I learned English watching As the World Turns with my mother. And the other parts came from watching Transformers in the morning.
How about you, Roy?
Missing the bus, going to my first day of school in Austin, Texas, and having my tennis shoes stolen and not speaking the language. Yeah, it was not a good start. Pretty tough when coming back from a country where, for me, everything clicked.
Now, you moved from Mexico with your mother, and she wanted to kind of reinvent herself. She had been working in business administration, and she wanted to study medicine. Where was your father in this?
Our father, he's a professor of economics, and so they had split a few years back, and so he was in Mexico City.
Roy, you joined the Marine Corps after high school, before entering college. Given your allegiance to Mexico, why did you join the Marines?
Literally, Saddam had invaded Kuwait, and I had been in this country for 4 years, and I had really come to the conclusion that whereas before I wanted to get back to Mexico as soon as possible, I had come to just love this country and the opportunities. And I felt that there was no way that I was ever really going to feel that this was my home the same way that my peers that have been born here. And so I just had this idea of what better way than join the Marines during the time of war.
After college, you both worked at MCI, the telephone company.
Now Verizon.
It was at MCI that the idea for NetSpend hatched. And it seems like you are both very unlikely people to start a financial services company, especially given that you were at a telephone company and you didn't have a background in financial services. How did the idea for NetSpend come to be?
We were living together at the time when we overlapped work at MCI WorldCom, and we were just talking about the internet boom and how there's a new business being hatched every day, it seemed like. And so you can imagine, especially in Austin, Texas, Michael Dell has just entered into the picture. And without living in Austin, I don't know if we would have had the momentum of entrepreneurship that we felt. Literally, it happened over a few days where we started talking about doing something together. I remember him walking into my room and saying, I got it. Mm-hmm. We're going to enable payments over the internet.
At the time, e-commerce was just blooming. And people were starting to buy things online. However, there was this whole population of people who didn't have access to credit cards. And the thought was, how are they going to transact? In what way did this stem from your own experience or frustration with the payment system?
As a student at the University of Texas and having had financial aid checks coming in from my GI Bill, I had come to understand that if I came in and I deposited my $2,000 check at my bank account, deposited my check on Friday at 4 p.m., guess what? Even though I had a debit card, I could not get the funds to clear my account until after midnight Monday, which puts it Tuesday. So if I needed to buy books on the internet, or if I wanted to buy flowers for my girlfriend from 1-800-Flowers, I couldn't do anything. The electronics seem to be there. They have my money. Why? Why can't I do this? And that was really what motivated us. We cannot possibly be the only ones.
While it was the early days, prepaid cards did exist in the form of phone cards, for example. And in what way did phone cards inspire you to just apply it to a different area?
In a big way for me. I mean, we were working directly in the industry, and we had context coming from Mexico where very popular way of transacting.
When we were at MCI, one of our college jobs initially was to sign people up to switch in long distance. And curiously enough, switching people from AT&T to MCI, that was easy. The ones that were super difficult were not only immigrants, but your average American that had gotten a $400, $500 phone bill, and they couldn't pay it. And they had gotten so burned with that experience that they decided, you know what, I'm going to buy prepaid cards. And we could tell that customer, Mr. Customer, you know, you can have the service for 5 cents a minute, and the prepaid card is 30 cents. And the customer would tell us, yes, I know. I know it's more expensive, but you know what? When I'm done with the card, I'm done with the card.
More control.
It's control. As a person, I have problems about maybe not exercising enough, maybe not having the right diet. And certainly, I'm going to have a problem with spending and saving. And if you can give me something where I can have control, that would be very powerful.
You launched the company with $750, which is basically the amount of money that it costs to incorporate.
$750 was utilized to incorporate, and that was really the catalyst to no going back.
So we put a list of friends and family, and it's really funny, the 20 people that we put on the list, they ended up not giving us any money. But what we ended up getting, these first investors are former employees at MCI. So think about people that were call center agents. When you're talking about an investment from a friend or a former employee that is $5,000 when their annual income, I know for a fact because they used to work for me, was $60,000, it's a big deal.
And then you looked to venture capital and you got a lot of no's because you didn't have experience. What were some other reasons why venture folks did not support you initially?
I'll give you the response that we got from one particular investor that we were looking for money from. And he looked at us and he said, you guys are hilarious. It's like you're trying to go to the Super Bowl and win, but you've got two players. I mean, I didn't even know what venture capital was mm-hmm. when we were looking for venture capital.
You ended up raising money from the help of the Small Business Administration. They had this SBIC program, which insured investments from venture funds, right? It backed or collateralized investments from venture funds. Is that right?
That is correct.
They supported one of our investors, early investors, they had received some money from the government, and it turned out that we were one of the portfolio companies of the year for the government.
And who was the venture firm?
Jeffenor,
here out of New York.
In the early days, you persuaded MasterCard to partner with you. How did you meet them?
We were introduced to them by our partner bank out of Texas.
And to their credit, they were very open. You got to remember, 1998, the internet is expanding. And back in those days, we basically said, look, we have an agreement with ExxonMobil for distribution of these cards. They need to be able to get their cash into the system. And how are you going to deal with that? And if you don't want to help us, that's fine. But then this is our first stop, and maybe we can go to American Express, or maybe we can go to Visa, but somebody's going to do it.
So Exxon was a real important ally for you in convincing the likes of MasterCard to work with you.
ExxonMobil being Fortune 1.
So, for example, when you think about MasterCard or Visa, they do not issue cards. Banks do. The biggest retail bank in America back then had a total of 5,000 branches. ExxonMobil had 15,000 locations. So the concept that you can actually reach people through a retail location instead of a bank branch was really an innovation in itself. The other thing that we also had was our technology. So because the stuff that we wanted to do had never been done before, the incumbents, they were very rigid. If you as a bank said, I want to change this and that, they would say, okay, we can make those changes, but it's going to cost you millions of dollars and it's going to be 2-3 years. They also were operating on mainframes. We had the benefit of, we were working on servers from the internet age, where instead of spending $20 million on infrastructure, we could do it for a couple million dollars faster, better.
How did you convince Exxon to make your cards available to the population?
They took a leap of faith on a pilot in Texas. And so literally hopped on a plane, went to see them in Fairfax, Virginia, said, hey, we want to do this. Here's a card. I remember putting a card in front of the gentleman that handled U.S. distribution for their C-stores. He picked it up, looked at it. This, by the way, had been a card that I had designed personally and printed and laminated and all that. And I remember he looked at it and said, okay, let's do it. And he signed the term sheet.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Bertrand and Roy Sosa, co-founders of NetSpend, a pioneer of prepaid debit cards for the underbanked. Launched in 1999, NetSpend provides cards and other financial services to people who don't have access to credit or bank accounts. It occurred to me that you are innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. You're serving people who have real needs, and one day these services will be or eventually were used by mainstream customers. And usually when we think of innovation, sometimes it happens top down, like at the top of the pyramid, and then eventually, you know, the people at the bottom would benefit. Have you thought about that dynamic?
We have. Today, globally, we now have programs in places like Kosovo, where we completely help rebuild the entire financial system in terms of the infrastructure for card issuance and acceptance. And, you know, the small business owner that now can order enzymes for his dairy business that he couldn't before.
Enzymes, yeah.
And that he couldn't do it before. And you asked this question of, you know, you started innovating at the bottom of the pyramid. Well, we have to be super low cost. You obviously can't talk about big fees. We have programs where literally we make $1 per customer per year. Okay, so for you to make it work, you have to leverage technology, you have to leverage partnerships. But once you do that, then all of a sudden you say, wow, I can actually deliver services to the top of the pyramid more efficiently, better service than the incumbents that have been used to high fees, because I had to figure it out. So instead of building a branch, I partnered with a grocery store. Instead of building a branch, I partnered with an airline.
Or a telco.
You are no longer affiliated with NetSpend. You started an investment fund called Empower, which invests in financial service companies serving the underbanked population. And unfortunately, it got off to a rough start in that you were the subject of a lawsuit and injunctions were filed against you from NetSpend, from the very company that you founded. And that was a tumultuous period for you, I'm sure. And the company contended that you were taking employees and that you had a non-compete and that you were starting companies that competed directly with NetSpend. What was your response to that?
No, my two cents on that is it was a silly time for both of us. There's just no reason for it. We clear the air between both sides.
The short answer is I can tell you all those things were dismissed. But at the same time, I will also tell you, because of confidentiality on the dismissal and whatnot, we really don't talk about it. But I can tell you from a human perspective, it is the equivalent of being sued by your child. For me, it was even more awkward as a founder to think about the fact that, okay, at the time, we were the largest individual shareholders. So if Netspend won, we lost. But if Netspend lost, we lost. And it just didn't make sense. You know, I've never sued anybody in my entire life. To me, it's disappointing when companies or individuals view the game as a zero sum. Like, if you're winning, I must be losing. So how do I get a piece of that? Netspend had the opportunity to go international for many years. Never did. There's nothing that prevents them from doing that.
So what you're saying is Netspend decided not to go into these other markets internationally, and there you saw an opportunity elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, we started doing things around mobile payments right away and going into other countries right away. And, you know, the product line spectrum that we have today is pretty significantly different than what you see back then.
Your focus now is on Rev Worldwide, which is a portfolio company of Empower, and they have a network of payment companies for those without access to banking. So similar to Netspend, but international. What are some examples, or who are some of the people whom are being affected by this?
In rural Mexico, there's no cell phone coverage. There's no mobile coverage. So we partnered with the telegraph company and with Huawei, who actually came in and put a satellite antenna, and we enabled everybody in a township of 500 families to be able to operate and be able to have both access to telecommunications, but also to the banking system.
The people in Mexico that are using the MiPhone product are impacted in a very, very real way. I mean, you have this merchant that's selling chicken, and now because he's able to take phone orders and have them be paid to his cell phone, he doesn't have to go to the collect the cash and then take the cash to the bank. And, you know, all these inefficiencies that when you think about, I mean, we may take them for granted, but when for somebody to go half a day across town, another half a day, come back, it's a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal in terms of time and money. And we have successfully bridged that divide through the mobile phone and through a debit card. Another way that Rev is impacting around the world, you're talking about cab drivers in Australia that are getting paid via their driver's card. Through our technology, their headquarters disperses the money directly to them. And, you know, I can go on and on about all the different examples.
Your mom is living in Texas currently. What does she make of all this?
It's really funny you ask that question, because throughout the early years at Netspend, I don't think she really understood what we were doing. When it relates to things about work, it's more about I need to, you know, help her reset her PIN, or I get a tickle out of that every single time.
Where was your father in this?
My father, who's a professor, he still would like for me to go out and finish some sort of graduate school. He's never been a big pro-capitalist or entrepreneur supporter, so there's a bit of unfinished business there.
You said your father's a professor of economics in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hmm. Is he socialist?
How did you guess? Why would have led you to believe that?
All you have to do is meet my mother and my father to understand why Roy is half mission-driven and half capitalistic-driven.
I grew up going to summer camps with the Boy Scouts, and every other year going to summer camps with the Cuban Pioneers. And I grew up with a poster of $6 Million Man next to the poster of Ernesto Che Guevara.
They
go hand in hand. I don't think you divorce one from the other.
You guys are two immigrants from Mexico, and Netspend had a $1.5 billion IPO in 2010, more recently was sold for almost $1.5 billion. Were you like, is this really happening to me?
Yeah, I all the time. You know, what I really pinch myself is, it's not necessarily the IPO or Netspend or the prepaid. I pinch myself that I was able to find the path of entrepreneurship. When I discovered that entrepreneurs, it wasn't necessarily a dirty word, But it was a very, again, a very empowering feeling. It blew my mind.
I want to elaborate on that concept of dirty word. From an entrepreneur's perspective, in Mexico, an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't know what they want to do. Being an entrepreneur is the guy that is just sort of wheeling and dealing. And so it was fantastic to really have come to a country at a time where this is really exploding. And if you can believe that, a couple of Mexican immigrants that came in on a tourist visa, that the visa had an expiration date, and that by all means should not be here, that we could create a company that could lead an industry, that could create so many jobs.
That is extremely empowering.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
My guests have been the financial service entrepreneurs, Roy and Bertrand Sosa. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. We'll be right back.